Now, as I heard it, in the fall of 1969, you got a tip from Jeffrey Cowan, who was then a columnist for the Village Voice, about this platoon leader named William Calley, who was about to be court-martialed for killing civilians. No, is that the way it went?
No.
Tell me how it went.
Jeffrey Cowan was a columnist, but he had a brother named Paul,
mm-hmm.
who later became, in the Clinton administration, I think head of the Voice of America, and then later became a dean at the University of Southern California Journalism School. He was then a lawyer doing anti-war stuff. So what I'm telling you now was a secret for 20 or so years. The Cowan brothers, both of them who knew about it, did not want me to talk about this, so I did not. And then they began to talk about it. But eventually, the gist of it is that Cowan had heard from he was doing anti-war stuff, defending Vietnam veterans who were refusing to fight, et cetera, were being accused of being going AWOL or going off to Canada. In any case, he heard in that grapevine about some soldier who went crazy at a certain base and shot up a lot of people, and that was relayed to me in Washington. This is in the fall of 1969. The war had been going on. Well, Nixon was president, and he was continuing the war. And at that point, it seemed unending. And that's what got me beginning to ask questions about it. A tip, I should also add that most of the salient facts that were given to me were wrong. Wrong base. It wasn't an enlisted man. It was an officer. The numbers were much more dramatic. The whole scene was much more dramatic. But initially, that did start me beginning to ask questions.
So you got a small grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and you took your Amex card, and you arrived unannounced to Fort Benning?
No. I didn't get a grant. Eventually, I did. But I did have an Amex card, and I always keep on thinking when I see those ads, you know, me and my American Express card, we uncovered a massacre. I never thought that would happen. But I did have an Amex card, and I later did apply for the Fund of Investigative Journalism. I got $1,000 from them later. But in the beginning, I just went off. What happened was I got this tip, and I was supposedly doing a book on Pentagon procurement for Random House. I published already a book on chemical and biological warfare, and I'd been Eugene McCarthy's press secretary. So I'd been around. I'd covered the Pentagon for a couple of years. And I hated that project because it was just so deadly dull. But one day I was in the Pentagon doing my thing, and I saw a colonel who had just been promoted to general, who I knew from my days as a correspondent for the Associated Press in the building. And the thing you know about the military is humor. It always works. It works anywhere. And he had just been promoted. He also got shot. He got badly wounded in the leg. And here he is in the corridor, and I see him, and I, instead of congratulating him normally, I accused him of shooting himself in the knee to get a star and all that stuff. And we had this badinage, and we're doing this conversation. And I said, "What are you doing now? What's your new assignment?" He said, "I'm working for the chief. I'm working for the chairman, the chief of the Air of the Army, General Westmoreland, had then been returned, and he was chief of staff of the Air Force. Oh, he's working in the boss's office." And I then said, "What about this guy that the story about somebody shooting up a bunch of people, a gin mill, I think, I thought I said, mm-hmm. I thought it was." And he stopped, and it was really one of those great moments, and he stopped, and he slammed his side of his hand into his bad knee, and he said, "Listen, Hirsch, that guy Kelly didn't shoot anybody higher than that." And so I had a name, and also I must tell you, and it's the great irony of our business, I naturally immediately, and he said, "You know, that's just between us, and no big deal," and I'm sure I agree with him. It wasn't a big deal. I didn't say to him, "Oh, my God, you've just put me on the trail of a great story." We don't do that in our profession. I'm sure I just said whatever I said. "No, don't worry about it," and then ran off and began to look up Callie.
And when he said this high, he meant children, small people.
He was talking about children that high. And, mm-hmm. In fact, there were, as you know, many children were killed in that incident. And from there, I could find a Cali who had been charged with basically manslaughter in a different base. The base that they initially told me was a base where special forces operate out of. He was in a different base in South Carolina. As I said, the salient facts of the first tip were wrong, but it didn't matter because it got me going. And then I learned he had a lawyer named Latimer, and I went out to the West Coast and interviewed him. That's what I needed my credit card for, to get a plane ride. You know, those are the days in which I'm embarrassed to tell you. We got 4 gallons of gasoline for a dollar. You could live on my wife is a social worker, and I was making, you know, very little money at $150 a week at best. And you could live. unlike now.
Mm-hmm. So you got to the lawyer.
The lawyer was interesting because he was a Mormon. He'd been again one of these stories. He'd been a Mormon, and he was an elder, and this is in Salt Lake City, and he'd been on the Court of Military Appeals for many years, and Callie retained him. I don't know how Callie knew to retain him. His name was Latimer. And before I left, I went to the Army Judicial Library, one of the legal offices or libraries in the Pentagon, and read a bunch of his cases. And I flew out to Salt Lake City, and when I went to his office, the first thing I engaged him with, naturally, I began to talk about his cases. And I'm sure he thought I was the nicest young man he'd ever met talking about those cases. And again, that's what we do. And I could tell this story anywhere I want. I could tell it about how smart I am in doing that. I could also tell us how slippery we are, you know, how swarmy it is to go and sort of mislead him. Not really, but, you know, play up to his ego, which is what we do for a living. It's all those things. As I think about it more and more, I always wonder about why anybody trusts a reporter sometimes. But I went there and I convinced him I was the nicest guy in the world. And eventually he began talking about the case. And eventually there was a document I saw. And it was an amazing document he let me read. And the first sentence of which it said, the Army accused First Lieutenant William L. Kelly Jr. of the murder of 111 Oriental human beings. It was as if, let's see, 10 Orientals equals one Caucasian and maybe 12, one African-American and maybe 11 for Hispanic. It was really very – as soon as I wrote about it with that phrase, the Army immediately rewrote the indictment or the charges and got rid of that. But that gave me the big start, and I figured out where Callie was. I spent a horrible long day looking for him, finally found him, interviewed him. And then Judge Latimer, what I had done, that I'd interviewed him, and Latimer did an amazing thing. He said to me, you know, if you write that interview, you're going to cost them any chance of a trial. And this is 1969. And by the way, as soon as I saw that document, I'd like to tell you, I thought, oh, my God, this is going to kill the war. It's going to hurt the war effort. But really, fame, fortune, glory, you know, raced through my mind. What a story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a great story.
So before we jump ahead, you said you had just a heck of a time trying to find him. You landed at the base. You didn't know where he was.
Oh, my God, I didn't know anything. I didn't even know he was there. I just knew the charge sheet was written at an Army base in South Carolina.
How did you find him?
Well, I'll tell you, I just started looking for him. I flew that night from the West Coast to via Chicago, I think, into Columbia, South Carolina, rented a car, went to the base, and at that time it was, again, 69, they were open. I was waved in. I parked my car. There was a main headquarters and five bases spread out. It was a 30, 40-mile complex. And I just started driving. Initially, I went to every prison. There were four or five prisons, Briggs or whatever they called them in the military, then Briggs. And I would just drive into the front and, you know, I had my ratty old suit on and a tie and a briefcase and a rental car. I'd get out and there'd be some sergeant. And I'd say, Sergeant, bring Kelly out. And after
you were posing as a lawyer.
I didn't say I was anything else, but I didn't say – if anybody asked me, I always said I was a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
But if he'd ask me, who are you, I'd say who I was. But most of the time, if they made that assumption, that's fine. And, of course, Cali wasn't in any of these bases, and I'm driving from one camp to another. And I went back to the main headquarters. It's time for lunch. I got there early in the morning. I'd been driving all night. And I'd done all the things you do. I went to the clubs, the various – you know, you do things. That's the – I can basically find anybody who's unlisted if I can even get some vague area where he lives. Everybody has to have their car serviced at a gas station or belongs to the local sports club at a local library. You'd be amazed what you can do without resorting to skullduggery, without paying off somebody to go through an American Express account or something, which also can be done, as you may or may not know. That's what private eyes do. But in any case, I'd gone to every sports club in the base and all the music clubs and everything, and I was sort of stuck. And then I remembered it's funny you asked me this question. I remembered when I worked in the Pentagon as a correspondent, the phone books are changed every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Here it was. Callie had come back, according to the lawyer, in August. And here it was in October of 1969. I'm looking for him, and the phone book was dated September. But if he came back in August – Well, I had a thought. So I got the base information. I called up the information office of the base telephone service. I got the chief operator, and I asked her to, when he came back, he hadn't been charged. He was under investigation. He was just a guy coming back. I asked if they would check the new listings for the old phone book, the last wave of new listings in August before the new book was published in September. And it took a long time, but they finally found a William L. Calley Jr. that was listed at an engineering base. So that was a great breakthrough, and it was a base 20 miles away, another one of these outlying, you know, there's a main camp and outlying bases, and most of these are large Army facilities. And I raced over to that base, and again, it was about 3 in the afternoon. It was an Army barracks with a modern Army barracks. Not that when I was in the Army, we lived in huts, but this was a concrete building with three floors and every bed beautifully made, and I ran around from one floor to another and couldn't see anybody. Finally, in the corner of one of the floors was a kid sleeping on a bunk, top bunk, and I thought this must be Calley because, you know, he wasn't an engineer. He was an officer in infantry, and this was an engineering battalion he was assigned to, and I remember kicking the bunk and waking up this blonde kid, and I said, "Wake up," and I said, "Calley." He said, "Who?" And I looked at him. His name was a Polish name. And he was sitting there, this very young 19-year-old, 20-year-old kid sitting there confused. And because we are nosy, I said, "What are you doing here at 3 o'clock in the afternoon?" And he then gave me, he was from Matuma, Iowa. And he had been in the military, had been in Vietnam, was coming back, and they lost his records. And he was waiting for them to find his records so they could discharge him. And meanwhile, he was missing the harvest. It was fall, as I said, November, back in the farm. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Oh, my God, what are you doing to kill your time?" And he said, I sort the mail. And I said, "Did you ever hear of a William Calley?" And he looked at me and said, "You mean the guy that shot up everybody?" And from there we went. And eventually he took me to another facility where there was the senior enlisted man in charge of the mail was there, and there were records there, and I convinced somebody to get Calley's personnel file out. This is a small Army base, and you can do anything you want. And I got a look at his file, which began, the personnel file, began with the same piece, the document I'd seen in the lawyer's office a long day earlier. And so Calley was then assigned to a private quarters outside the base in Columbia, South Carolina. And I went to where he was living, and there were four young guys there that had just gotten out of West Point. You know, they were just the first assignment after graduating in June from West Point. I'm sure many of them went off to Iraq, to Vietnam. God knows how many lived. Anyway, Calley wasn't there anymore, but he had told them what a great hero he was, and I got that story. And then they told me where he was. He was living, get this, the one place nobody would look for him, in the senior bachelor officer's quarters, which is where, for lieutenant colonels and hires, you know, we're talking about a place with a tennis court and a swimming pool. The last place you'd think, particularly somebody who'd been in the Army like me, a potentially criminal murder first lieutenant would be stashed, but he was stashed there. So I spent, there were about 100 rooms there. I just started walking through each room, knocking on doors, saying, "Hey, Bill Calley." And I spent maybe 3 or 4 hours doing that with no luck. And I left. It was dark by now, 9, 10 o'clock, and there was a guy working on his car with one of those lights that you run a wire, you know, mechanics have a light that under the car. He was doing work, and I was so exhausted, I was going to go to a motel and check in and wake up at 3 and knock on everybody's door again, figured, you know. Just, yeah. And I went to that guy, and he was a warrant officer, and I said, "Calley?" And he crawled out. He was one of those little pulleys you have. He pulled himself out from under the motor, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're looking for William Calley?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "He lives below me." And he was somebody who knew the story. And Calley was on a boat that day. He'd gone boating. And I waited for 3 or 4 hours. When he came in to the barracks, to the fancy barracks, I was waiting for him. And I said, "Are you Calley? I'm Hirsch." He said, "Oh, yeah, my lawyer said you'd look me up," as if I found him so easily. This is 12, 13 hours of looking. And then he spent the night with me and told me his story, which was sort of crazy, but he told me his story and pretended to be very cocky and calm. But at one point, must have been 4 or 5 in the morning, we were drinking beer, and he went to the bathroom, and he left the door open and had a mirror in it. And I saw he vomited bright red arterial blood, which I knew then he had an ulcer probably as big as a quarter or half dollar. And it was a pose. In any case, when I told the lawyer that Callie had told me all these things, the lawyer made a deal. He said, I'll let you say that you've talked to me and I verified the story and I will verify it if you don't write that you interviewed him, if you just say Callie is known. And I did it. I said Callie is known to have said. And what made that story work is we were freelancers. Nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted that story. But we distributed to 50 newspapers. And the newspaper business is not dead. I'll tell you, I'm a firm believer in it. We called, I had a friend named David Obst who just got on the phone. We called editors and said, we have a great story coming. And even though I wasn't well known, I'd been press secretary for Eugene McCarthy when he was running for the presidency and written a lot of speeches for him. And I'd written just a month earlier, two earlier, a long piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, the lead piece. So people sort of knew me. And they all looked at the story and it said, call the lawyer and for Callie. And they called the lawyer and he said, I've talked to Hirsch and I can verify the story. And so off we went. I think it was about 35 front pages the next day.
Now, let's talk about something else that happened at the base. Not only did you speak to Callie, but you spoke to other people there.
Yes.
And you noted that all of them were surprised. I think amazed was the word that you used, that the story hadn't yet appeared in the media. Why did it take so long?
Well, I think one of the questions you have to is one of the things that really disturbed me is after the story came out that, you know, there was sort of a little bit like what happened with Abu Ghraib, if you remember a couple years ago mm-hmm. when I did stuff for The New Yorker. There was sort of like, what's he going to do next? There was, you know, I did a story and then I did a second story and the media began, I began getting incredible amounts of money. You know, I can't, thousands of dollars for the third, fourth and fifth story from newspapers wanting to buy the next one. And after the second or third story, by which time the My Lai massacre was a firestorm, a lot of reporters who were there in Vietnam at the beginning began to write their story of what they saw. And I remember one AP story in particular, somebody was in the first or second week of the war, there were a group of civilians in a cave and Marines or soldiers just firebombed them, you know, just threw a flamethrower in there. And so we began to see, there was just a reluctance to talk about what our guys did. You know, we in America, we never, in World War II, we were censored pretty much from what the real battlefield was. There's been a lot of definitive academic work. Paul Fussell at Yale has written quite a bit about it, about the fact that we weren't allowed to see photographs of American dead and wounded. So we were, you know, and we also thought that, you know, I grew up, Brooke, I grew up, I was born in 37. During the war, my older sisters would take my brother and I to the local theater and we watched the war movie. And in the war movies I saw, it was always John Wayne, Richard Widmark were always pilots flying against the Nips. The Japs were always, and our guys always flew with the canopy open, scarves, no headgear, thumbs up. And the Nips always had these little leather helmets that they, you know, geek helmets that they tied around under their chin. And the canopies were closed and they squinted. And at a critical moment, one American soldier would rescue another and fire bullets. And there'd be a moment where the Nip, the Jap plane, would go down and you'd hear the, and just before the plane hit the water, a trickle of blood would come out of the corner of the Nip's mouth and we'd all cheer.
Right.
And so we always thought we fought the war better and differently than the Nips or the Germans. And of course, the Holocaust is something else, but I'm talking about in combat. And the idea that in combat we're all the same was not something we really knew. And so here's a guy writing. Here's this kid with no, you know, this is not the New York Times, writing from an anti-war dispatch news service story, writing a story about a major massacre. 550 people were killed, the most unwanted, horrible massacre. And it went against the myth. So who's going to crash this myth that somehow we fight war better? We know now. We do know now. We know now that, you know, wars are, there's no such thing as a good war. I mean, there may be a just war, but there isn't a war in which everybody escapes unscathed.
But we didn't know it then. Now, you were saying that reporters who were there on the scene, who had seen such things, began to write about them. But it wasn't just reportorial reticence that kept this out of the newspapers for so long. There was also an effort by the military not to let these things out.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, there's always that. I mean, you know, as much as I can complain about the Nixon White House, I assure you, the Clinton White House was just as eager to keep bad stories from the press as these guys are. That's a given. And the military, of course, were. The fact is, reporters had seen things that didn't write about it. There was a self-censorship mechanism that was very strong. And that's inevitable. I wasn't in Vietnam. I wasn't being flown around by the military. I didn't use their communications. I wasn't relying on them. And in a funny way, it's ironic. I'm in the same position now as, a guy working for The New Yorker. The White House is useless to me, the National Security Advisor. I do my things on the fringes. And there's nothing wrong with being assigned to the White House. It's just my complaint about the press today is that we meet more people on the fringes, too, not being reliant. But that's just the way it is. There's always a self-censorship mechanism. If you go covering the White House and you start going at them about inconsistencies, you're not able to do your job. You don't get the access. And that's always the playoff, the trade-off that exists with the major, what we call the mainstream media.
Right. If you want to keep access, then you don't get to say everything that needs to be said. But interestingly enough, when you were covering this story, your subsequent dispatches had the testimonies of Michael Terry and of Michael Bernhardt, people who were at the scene, two soldiers who were very candid about what happened. How did you find them, and why were they so willing to open up about something so horrible?
There was a tremendous willingness to talk about something so horrible because Michael Terry had participated quite a bit. Bernhardt had not. I found him, I think, for the first story, actually. He was somebody that when I began to look, and after I'd done the first story, I ran into this wonderful soldier. He's now dead, Ronald Reidenauer. There's a prize now given in his honor every year. Ronald Reidenauer was a soldier who learned about this right away and tried to get something done through the system without any success. And after I wrote my first story, there was I'm watching the newspapers, and there's the Phoenix Gazette. He was then a kid out of Phoenix. Had a story about somebody who claimed he was the guy who initiated it. It was just a two-paragraph add-on to a story about me lie that was in the Sunday Washington Post. And I knew that had to be the connection. Something started. And I called Reidenauer. He was a student at Pomona College or Claremont College in California. I went out to see him, and he gave me a company roster. He started me. He gave me a company roster. And from there, I could some of the names were spelled so unusually, and I could get some idea from right now what state they were in. He knew the people in that company pretty well. And I began to find the kids. When I found Mike Terry in Orem, Utah, it was about 5 days later. I remember I was driving through heavy snow in Utah. I went from Salt Lake City to this little town. And he was living in a small house with a bunch of brothers and sisters. And gas, I remember there was a gas burner. And I woke him up at 3 or 4 in the morning. And I got him out. I'll never forget. I told him what I was and what I was doing. And he said to me, do you want me to tell you the same thing I told the colonel? An army had already investigator had been there. And he began by saying it was a Nazi type thing. And I had another incident where there was a boy named Paul Meadlow, who had been one of the most avid shooters. Lieutenant Calley had told everybody to shoot. He just said, he put people in three ditches. What happened is they were told they'd been in the country, this company, Charlie Company, for about 10 or 11 weeks. And they all have been told you're going to be fighting the North Vietnamese regular army. They saw nobody. There isn't an Iraqi analogy. There was no army. They were a 100-guy-strong company. They lost maybe 15 or 20 guys to snipers and bombs. And they were very angry, and they were beginning to take it out on the population. They were told March 15th, tomorrow morning, you're going to meet the enemy for now, for once. You've been here for 3 months. You haven't seen a bad guy. Now you're going to see the bad guys. And they did what that army did then. They toked up with their joints, and the enlisted men and officers drank. But they got up at 3:30 to kill and be killed. You got to give them their due. They jumped on choppers. They go to this village. They march in looking scared to death, thinking they're going to be in a firefight. There's 500 people sitting around making breakfast, all women, old men, old women, and children. No young men of fighting age. They gather them in three ditches. They begin to shoot. Calley orders his young men to start shooting. The Hispanic and blacks, by and large, shot high. All of this is amazing because it wasn't their war. It's Whitey's war. They're not interested in it. They weren't going to not shoot because they didn't want somebody to put a bullet in their back.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a bunch of farm kids shooting, regular army. One was Paul Meadlow, and he shot and shot and shot. And at the end of it, they had everybody in a ditch, And when they were all done, they sat along the ditch and had their lunch. Don't ask me how, why. And they heard her keening. And one of the mothers in the bottom of the ditch, there were three ditches that they fired bullets into, one of the mothers had tucked a boy underneath, a 2 or 3 year old boy, and he crawls up. What I'm telling you, I learned in real time, but it's empirical. It came out the same way in all of the Army investigations and the trial of Callie. This little boy climbed up out of the bodies full of everybody else's blood and began to run in a panic. Callie said to Meadlow, Paul Meadlow, this kid from southern Indiana, plug him. Meadlow, one-on-one, couldn't do it, although he'd fired maybe 10 clips of 20 bullets each into the ditch. So Callie, with great daring do, grabs officers had a small rifle known as a carbine, took his carbine, ran behind the kid and shot him in the back of the head. Everybody remembered that. The next morning, Meadlow, they're on patrol. Meadlow gets his leg blown off to the knee, and they call in a helicopter, medevac they call it, to take him out. And while he's waiting, he starts issuing an oath, a real oath, a chant. God has punished me, Lieutenant Callie, and God is going to punish you. God has punished me. And the kids, when they finally began to tell me about it, and I didn't learn about this for 2 weeks, although everybody knew the story. When the one told me, they all told me. I'd seen 6 or 7 kids before I learned about it. Talk about repressed memory. They all said, they kept on screaming, get that chopper, get this guy out of here. So I hear this story. This is the third story I wrote of Paul Meadlow. He lives in southern Indiana. I'm somewhere in America. I call every, you could call information for free. I'm at an airport, of course, and I just dial away. And I call every exchange in Indiana. Finally, New Goshen, Indiana, which is below Terre Haute, which is below Indianapolis, which is below Chicago. That's where he lives. We're not talking about any Google now or search engines. I fly to Chicago, go to Terre Haute, get a car, go to New Goshen, spend hours. It's a chicken farm. Meadlow's back. It's a year and a half after the incident. He was shot. He's home now on this farm. It's a chicken farm. Run down, clearly no man around, chickens all over the place, a shack house. Out comes his mother. I'd called the night before, and she answered the phone, and I said I was coming. Can I talk to him? And she said, I don't know. I said, I'll see you the next morning. So this mother walks out. She's 50, looks 70, and she comes up to him, and I introduced myself, my ratty suit again. I said I was a reporter. I wanted to talk to him. I knew what happened. I wanted to talk about his leg. And she said, well, he's in there. She said, I don't know if he'll talk to you. And then this woman, this old southern uneducated woman, she said to me, I'm telling you, click, click, quote, unquote, she said, I gave them a good boy and they sent me back a murderer. I mean, you can't do it any better than that. I go see the kid and the first thing I do is I spend 20 minutes talking about his leg. And then I said, what happened? He said, I just began to kill people. It's just, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something I don't tell many people. What she meant was this. He'd been married at 16, and he impregnated his wife. And when he came back, there was a baby. And when he first came back home after getting a new leg, or the artificial leg that he had, when the baby started crying at night, they learned they had to keep him away because the first time he woke up, he was beginning to slam the baby because mm-hmm. those cries were reminding him of things. It is. And I'll tell you something. You can take the same story and talk about the kids in Iraq. And I have, after Abu Ghraib, I learned an awful lot about what goes on.
This is where I want to go next.
Well, you don't have 3 weeks for the show, do you?
No. Another enormous story you broke much more recently was the mistreatment, the prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib. And some have drawn parallels between My Lai and Abu Ghraib. Do you think it's fair?
Well, I mean, in yes and no. No, because the people at Abu Ghraib were as much victims as the soldiers at My Lai were. In other words, I did a book, the first book I did in My Lai, I did a couple, one about the cover-up, but the first book was, ended. The last sentence, if I recall, was the kids who did the shooting were as much victims. What were they doing in that war? And you have the same analogy. What is this group of reservists who were trained to be military policemen doing, running a prison that should have been destroyed? It was an infamous prison in Saddam's days. For the Americans to rebuild it and put prisoners there was just another piece of madness. But in any case, they weren't killing people. But the same analogy in the sense that you do take it out when you don't have an enemy and you're being bombarded with shells and insurgencies. You do take it out on the population. I've talked to a lot of young, not a lot, but a dozen young officers who were, you know, leaders, company commanders and platoon leaders, you know, first and second lieutenants. And the one thing you have in common is they couldn't stand their job because 95% of them was from keeping kids from doing terrible things to the civilian population of Iraq. If you don't see the enemy and you're losing people through landmines, we had 5 Americans killed this week in an incident.
I think 8.
Well, there were 5 in one incident when a suicide bomber, and by the way, my friends tell me it was a she, the bomber. There's that's one of the issues. There's been a lot more women doing this. In any case, the other soldiers, what are they going to do? They've lost 5 buddies in this one incident. There were 8 in one day, but in 5 in one case. The rage toward the civilian population has got to be immense. And it's the same thing. You know, our boys now, our men and women in the field now, they have tremendous stress, and it's not – it's amazing. In the old days, they did dope, they did heroin, and they did tie sticks and marijuana. Now it's different. Now the soldiers that get through a night are given Ambien, and many of them are given Zoloft, anti-anxiety pills to get through a night. And I'm not exaggerating. Sometimes they get 2 or 3 Ambien a night. So the drugs are going the other way now. I mean, the irony of irony. And it's the same story, you know. After I did, I think, 3 stories in 3 weeks for The New Yorker, which I will tell you is no fun. I mean, the last person you deal with at The New Yorker, besides the fact checkers, is the grammarian. You're undead, and they want to talk about comma faults and parallelism. And, boy, they mean it. You better not mess around. You better have a serious conversation about comma consistency and parallelism. In any case, in between that, I'm doing shows, and I was on a NPR show, one of the afternoon talk shows, and somebody called in, and a woman calls in and said, I had a child in the unit.
And at Abu Ghraib.
Yep. I go see her. I gave her my phone number over the air. And I figured that most people listening to afternoon radio are either driving or they don't have a pen and pencil with them. And she called a couple of days later. I go to see her, and she had a child come back, completely changed, was in Abu Ghraib, wasn't charged, just one of those people, came back and was completely withdrawn, had a husband, left the husband, left the family, moved to another city. She went and got a computer. Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's
just
okay.
Just turn it off. You're going to. Here, give it to me. I didn't turn off my phone.
So you were saying she moved to another city.
Yeah, the child moved to a nearby city. And so at some point, the woman who called me remembered that she brought home a portable computer. One of the things about this war is there's no fun to be had on R&R in Iraq. So every kid has a CD player so they can watch movies and play games. That's something I didn't know until I got into this. It's just sui generis. You have to have a computer. A DVD player. And so she took the computer that the child had brought back and began to go through it and erasing it. She claimed, this is not Freud here, she claimed that it was just innocent, not she didn't have any other thoughts. There was a file marked Iraq, and she hit a button, and out came 80 photographs. And the one that The New Yorker published was the iconic photograph of the naked man in front of bars, hands behind his head, two Belgian shepherds snarling at his feet. Mm-hmm. Everybody remembers that photograph. Well, in the sequence that this woman, this mother saw, 80 pictures, the dog attacked the man, blood all over. The last picture, they're trying to attack the man in a sensitive spot. They're trying to sew up. You can see a soldier trying to sew up. What a set of pictures. And the New Yorker's position, I thought, was, I mean, we ran that one photograph. It's not protecting the military. How much more damage can you do? It's really the sense of how much can you humiliate the Arab man? You know, in the Quran, it says no Arab is supposed to be seen by another male naked. And it says it twice. I mean, that's a very strong thing, privacy.
So that was how you got those pictures.
But here's the point. The woman, I had to get permission from the young child. The woman's in terrible shape, the young woman who was in the unit. And really, you have to deal with that in some way consistent with – anyway, months later, after it's all over, she gives me the photograph. She probably at that point, at the height of the Abu Ghraib crisis, this is the second week, could she have gotten $100,000 from a network for these pictures? Probably more. She just gave it. Mm-hmm. Six months later, I took her to dinner. I was giving a speech somewhere in the area. And she told me the following story, which is that what she hadn't told me earlier is that when the child came back, every weekend she moved out of the house, left her husband, left the family. Every weekend she began, a beautiful woman, light complexion, blonde, but very pretty, so I was told, began to get tattoos, dark tattoos. And she every week, every time they saw her, more and more tattoos. Eventually she filled up her body up to the neck with dark, dark tattoo, tattoos. And the woman said to me at one point, it was as if she, the soldier, had wanted to change her skin. So you really, you're talking about the same thing. I gave him a good boy. They sent me a murderer.
Exactly. And so there's the comparison. I'm just wondering, though, isn't remembering history supposed to prevent us from repeating it?
Are you suggesting that the American leadership learns from the past? Are you really suggesting that? That we learn from history in America? Excuse me. I don't think there's much evidence for that. Fighting a guerrilla war in a country about which we know very little about the culture or the language, and having a disaster in the middle 70s, and doing it again in 2003 with the same sort of disaster, not predictable. Yes, it was predictable. And by the way, somebody will do the history. There wasn't a general consensus that Iraq was WMD posed a threat. I mean, there was an awful lot of resistance, and that's pretty much known, but not even the extent. The point I'm making simply is that as we had hell to pay after Vietnam, we're going to have hell to pay among our own soldier population from this war. And that does not even begin to deal with the catastrophe that we've visited on Iraq and the Iraqi society and the Iraqi children who have grown up. We're now in the fifth, sixth year of this utter madness they've been growing up in, this psychotic madness. And what do we owe them? And you know what word never occurs to me and never is said publicly? Morality. Nobody ever talks about this war in terms of what our moral position should be. Are we immoral in doing it? Walking away from Iraq, as everybody wants to do, and I support getting out of Iraq, but I do also think that we really have an obligation to that society, and to simply pretend that the Maliki government, the Shia government there is at fault because it's not taking advantage of the great opportunity we gave them to run their own country is comical. We have a real serious, long-standing, long-term obligation to try and repair the damage there that nobody talks about, and not only the physical damage, just the other damage that we've just been talking about here.
Cy, thank you very much.
Goodbye, kiddo.
Seymour Hersh is the national security correspondent for The New Yorker.